One Nation makes history in the Farah by-election, crushing the coalition in its regional heartland, now setting its sights on taking more seats. It was never going to be a good night for the Liberals, but few expected a result this bad. Shadow Treasurer Tim Wilson joins us this morning. I'm David Spears. Welcome to Insiders. It's budget week, and on Tuesday night, Jim Chalmers will unveil the Albanese government's boldest move to date. Labor is overhauling investment tax breaks, despite ruling this out at last year's election. Negative gearing will be limited to newly built homes, and capital gains tax will revert to the less generous Keating-era model. While the government prepares to spend some political capital here, the coalition starts budget week humiliated by a by-election drubbing of historic proportions. Support for the Liberals collapsed in Farah. Voters surged to One Nation, giving the party its first lower house win. Pauline Hanson is on a high and dreaming big. Angus Taylor is facing difficult questions about the future of the Liberal brand.
Candidates have been making their final pitches to voters in the regional New South Wales seat of Farah.
Yeah, no, exactly. They're just forgotten.
If the pre-polls are anything to go by, One Nation could make history.
I'm for One Nation at the moment.
Which way you've decided to go?
Michelle Milthorpe.
You like the appeal of Michelle?
I like Michelle. My parents are supporting One Nation, David Farley, so that's what we're supporting.
The Greens and Michelle Milthorpe.
One Nation all the way.
One Nation, what about you?
And One Nation.
Thank you for your support, thank you.
Are you getting a video?
Yes, I have.
In the back. I had never assaulted anyone.
Things should never cross the line into physical altercations as that did.
Patterson was slinking around like a mongrel dog looking for a fight.
Orange Force One has landed.
Welcome to Albury, Senator.
Hi. Are we ready?
Like this. Hi Pauline, we just want to have a quick chat if that's okay.
We're not offering interviews to the ABC at the minute.
How are you feeling ahead of tomorrow's vote?
Actually, really good.
It's cold today in Farah, winter's arriving. But I can tell you what, the burning desire of change within the constituents is there.
The time is now for us to look at different representation.
People could say to us, One Nation is the last hope.
Let's go, One Nation!
Who for?
I think I'll follow
you.
Yeah, I hope you're right.
Okay, done. You're all done.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I've got three clear jobs to do. I've got to win today. I've got to make sure that we're ready for the next election, and I want to help Pauline Hanson and its team build a powerful political party for Australia.
I've done as much work as I can up to this point, and now we've just got to wait for the votes to be counted.
At the moment, One Nation is benefiting from the flow of preferences.
Michelle Milthorpe underperforming a little bit, One Nation overperforming, and then look again, the swing against the Liberal Party there.
That is a huge collapse in the Liberal vote.
If the decision was made that the preferences should be in a particular order to affect that, so be it.
The next member for Farah is David Farley.
One Nation has reached the end of its beginning.
Western Sydney, here we come.
And we have to take away some hard lessons from this.
Three great ladies here tonight with me. One of the greatest.
This is not only a win for Farah, it's a win for the rest of Australia.
Well, the ABC's chief elections analyst, Casey Briggs, and his trusty touchscreen are here with us this morning. Great to see you, Casey. Look, One Nation was expected to win last night, but the scale of this and the scale of that Liberal collapse, was that a surprise?
I think the numbers for One Nation are on the higher end of what anyone was really predicting last night, David. At the end of counting overnight, now we've got all the pre-poll voting centres in, David Farley has fallen just under 40% to 39.4. The Albury pre-poll voting centre, a very big early voting centre, has helped Michelle Milthorpe and got her up to above 28 percentage points. But one of the big stories of the night, obviously, is this combined coalition vote of about 22.5 percentage points, which, again, that's lower than numbers I was certainly hearing around what expectations might be for the combined coalition vote. And so we're left in this very interesting and unique scenario where, for the first time essentially in modern political history, you've got to go right back to the beginning of the Liberal Party to find a time when no major party, no Liberal, no National, no Labor candidate is in the final two in a seat in the Federal House of Representatives. That is the scale of this plunge. The Liberal vote down 31 points and much of it transferring across to One Nation. Michelle Millthorpe's primary up a little bit, but nowhere near enough to win here. And it's turning into a two-candidate preferred vote of, on our current estimates, current count, about 57.3% for One Nation. That is a margin just a little bit better than what Susan Lee won this seat on in 2025. And we can see that story on the map as well. This is the sea of orange. Let me flick you back to 2025 and briefly show you what the results were in these booths last election. Susan Lee won every booth pretty much outside of Albury. David Farley has won them and in many cases won them on larger margins in this election. The only exception is the city of Albury, the biggest city in Farrer, where Michelle Millthorpe has again won all but one of these polling places. But crucially, she's won them with a smaller margin than she did last election. Millthorpe was the beneficiary of a lot of disaffected major party voters in 2025. It seems like in this election, she's been swept away and the disaffected voters have swung behind One Nation.
Now, I can't resist having a go at your touchscreen, Casey. Now, this is interesting because we saw Barnaby Joyce last night talking about, well, Western Sydney is next. It's a different part of the country. I'm really interested in these seats. Mm. These seats, look at the One Nation results. They're pretty strong in those bordering parts of the electorate. What does that tell us about who should be nervous about where One Nation goes next?
Yeah, One Nation's getting about 40% in this seat. It got 6 and 6 point something percent in the last federal election in Farrer, just 12 months ago. This was a sort of average seat for One Nation, and there are many seats that One Nation did better. So where you'd be looking, well, look at all these very orange polling places. You've got the seat of Parks, held by a National on more than 10%. You've got Riverina, that's Michael McCormick, the former leader's seat, on a notionally safe margin. You've got Mallee, south of the Murray River, and Webster's seat. And here you've also got Nicholls, the seat held by Sam Birrell. Just here is Indi, an independent-held seat, but there are many seats that look, you know, a bit like Farrer, with lots of small towns that have swung, you know, 80%, 75%, big One Nation margins in many of these small towns. So look across regional inland New South Wales, inland Queensland, even parts of Victoria potentially, where could Nationals MPs, perhaps these four in seats touching Farrer, may not have had the easiest night's sleep last night.
No, they might be feeling a little nervous. Casey Briggs, thank you very much for that. Well, as the Liberals lick their wounds, there was some finger-pointing last night. Former leader Susan Lee suggested there was now an even greater need for change than when she was toppled 3 months ago. While Angus Taylor pointed to the previous chaos and told us he's trying to get the party back on track.
We all have to take responsibility for the situation that the Liberal Party and the Coalition is in. You know, that's, if we don't take responsibility, we won't fix it, David. I am absolutely focused now on fixing the situation we were in. It has been, as I said many times, it's an existential situation for the Coalition, and we have to get back to those convictions.
Referencing One Nation over Michelle Millthorpe, was that a good idea in hindsight?
Look, well, I am very confident that's what our voters in this electorate wanted us to do, and that's what we did.
So it was the right call?
Yes.
Well, let's bring in our panel this morning. We are joined by Nikki Saver, author and columnist with the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, Greg Brown, chief political reporter for The Australian, and Melissa Clark, host of the ABC's AM program. Very good morning to all of you the morning after. Very happy Mother's Day too for all the mums, including mine, out there. Hope you're having a lovely morning. But just let's, Nikki, start on what's happened last night. We heard Angus Taylor there defending the decision to preference One Nation ahead of the independent Michelle Millthorpe. Was that the right call, and what does this result mean for Angus Taylor?
Well, the result last night, when you look at it, was a fundamental rejection of everything that the Liberal Party stands for, and which is not very much, and people don't really actually know what it is. And if you look at it, it was not just a vote, a protest vote against the major parties. It was a vote in favour of One Nation. And I think Angus Taylor, by defending the preference decision, still doesn't understand, really, what was involved in that. It was wrong politically and it was wrong morally. It gave a signal to Liberal voters that it was okay to vote for One Nation. And they took him up on it in huge numbers. And I think when you get a result like that, where you're struggling to get your primary vote to double digits, it means that you have to change absolutely every single thing about yourself and the party. And if you don't do that, then when he says you change or die, and you haven't changed, then it's only the other option left.
Just on that point, Greg, is there much internal angst about the preference decision here, that they've given One Nation credibility, legitimacy by putting them ahead of the independent?
There is. I think this will be an ongoing debate within the Liberal Party about whether they do preference deals with One Nation because they feel that's the best way to overall chuck Labor out, or whether, you know, they put One Nation below Labor and just try and kill them off as best as possible. I tend to think that, based on my conversations, the majority view is that no matter what the Liberal Party does, One Nation in some form is there to stay. And I think, you know, there's even some Liberal MPs who are open to the idea of a future coalition with One Nation, although that's nowhere near
or a minority government type
arrangement. Yeah, yeah. So while I think this preference debate will play out, I wouldn't be surprised if going into the next election there is a deal with the Liberal Party and the Nationals and One Nation.
Yeah, well, we'll see. What about for Labor, Mel? Is there any nervousness, or should there be any nervousness in Labor about this being a tidal wave that's going to come against all major parties?
There is definitely a nervousness within Labor that I think is reflected across all of the established parties, which is this is a signal of dissatisfaction with the status quo, and any party that is seen to be as part of the status quo, whether they're in government or opposition, feels that. So there is, but I think there are a few things to temper that. This is clearly a pivotal moment in Australian politics, without a doubt. But I think it's really hard to know exactly how much we can extrapolate from this result to Australian politics more broadly. I mean, we do have, as much as we have disaffected voters, we have tactical voters. It's been really clear for quite a while that this was going to be a two-horse race between One Nation and Michelle Millthorpe. And I think when we look at some of the results that Casey was pointing to, let's look at the Greens vote falling apart. I don't think that's necessarily dissatisfaction with the Greens party. I think that's Greens voters knowing this is a two-horse race and choosing to send their vote to Michelle Millthorpe. So we've got tactical voting.
We have no incumbent. That really changes the picture, not having an incumbent. Matt Cavanagh, I think it was, that said this was really a free kick by-election, and I think he's right. And I think a lot of the Nationals, particularly in those surrounding seats that you were pointing to, will be hoping that incumbency makes a really big difference when we get to a general election. And then, of course, the regions aren't the entire country. The views you get in Farrah aren't going to be the views you get in Western Sydney or southeastern Melbourne or southeastern Queensland. So that's not to say this isn't a significant moment, but it is to say there's a really big question mark about how much we can extrapolate from it.
I tell you what, though, for Pauline Hanson and One Nation, clearly the wind is in their sails. They're taking a lot of momentum from last night. Look at Pauline Hanson on the stage, where it was just excitement in the room, and starting to talk about new policy moves as well, including on the hot topic of gas right now, and even suggesting something that I suspect even some in the Greens might like the sound of.
What I want is a system where we will own part of the equity share in the exploration and of gas. So we are not just going to allow them to take it. That money will then be put into a fund where no future governments can just willy-nilly give it away to other countries, waste it, get rid of it, but that will pay down our debt and give us the facilities, what we need, and the infrastructure.
government-owned gas projects. Is this the next hot debate when it comes to gas?
This is so interesting, and hopefully we can talk more about gas through the course of the program because this is a hot topic. But it's really interesting because I think all the political parties recognise that there is public consensus about the need to have a better share from the extraction of our resources. But there are totally different ideas about what is the best way to do about it. And here we see One Nation delivering a policy that we'd probably more closely associate with views on the left of nationalising industries. It's very curious.
All right, we'll come back to all of this. Time to talk to the Shadow Treasurer, Tim Wilson. First, out on the streets of Farrer this week, thoughts on the Liberal Party were clear.
I think they've just been doing nothing, so time for some change.
I was really disgusted in the way they've carried on the last couple of years.
I was a Liberal.
Right, so you've gone Liberal to One Nation.
Yes.
Do you think you'd ever go back? How do you feel about the Liberal Party now?
Depends, how long do you believe?
I don't know, I think they're all up in the air.
And have they lost you forever, the Libs?
I think so.
Tim Wilson, welcome to the program.
Thanks, David. And so, happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there.
Indeed. Look, the Liberal vote in Farrer, as you know, has gone from 43% just 12 months ago to 12% yesterday. Who and what is responsible for that?
Well, I think we need to caveat. We also had the national vote last election. The Nationals didn't contest the results. So we've seen about a halving of our vote, which is not to downplay it. It is a serious situation. But what it reflects is the need for us to be bigger, better, bolder, confident Liberals defining the future of the country. There's a lot of messages out of this by-election, David. There's absolutely some for us. As some of your panellists have just outlined, I think there'd be some nervous Labor MPs because what people want to see is change. And I was on the Moama booth yesterday chatting to voters and raising issues with them, or they were raising issues with me. And one of the most consistent messages is people want somebody who's going to fight for them and for their future. And a lot of the decisions were clearly made before the past couple of weeks, and people are going to be very antagonistic towards the government breaking its promises on tax issues in the lead up to the budget. So if they keep behaving like this, I expect it's going to come for them too.
We'll come to the budget. Just on what this means now for the Liberal Party, how do you think this result reflects on Angus Taylor?
Well, it shows that there's a lot of work we've got to do, and Angus has been very upfront about that yesterday in his commentary, and that the work needs to keep going on. We're obviously coming up to the budget, but we need to outline very clearly a bold and confident vision for the country about where we want to take it. The idea that the pendulum just politically swings between Liberal and Labor is simply no longer right. There are different axes, and it goes in all sorts of directions, including up and down, and we've got to be the party focused on building the future of the country and projecting out that vision and that sense of confidence so people feel confident going to vote for us.
Bigger, bolder, and that confident vision of the future. I want to take you to what Angus Taylor said last night after this result. He was immediately talking about stopping mass migration and ditching net zero. Is the solution for the Liberal Party here to keep chasing those issues on the right from One Nation?
Well, we have to obviously outline what we're opposed to, but most importantly, we have to define what we're for.
And we have to be clear?
So, well, I can assure you in the coming weeks, we're going to make it very clear what we're for, because Australians need to know that we're in favour of families, communities and small business and self-starters, because they're the foundations of our economic success, of our social success and building out a future that's brighter and more confident for everybody. And we don't just need to do it in words, we need to do it in deeds, in how we fight for it, and most importantly in the policies we put forward so Australians fight for us, because their future will be brighter under a Liberal-led government.
You've previously said mass migration is not a term that you use. Are you honestly comfortable with the use of this, the direction that Angus Taylor's talking about here?
Well, my focus on migration is always on how we make sure that we get new Australians integrated successfully. That's not just around social integration and cultural integration, though they're very, very important. We want people to love Australia, to be committed to Australia, and most importantly, to have economic pathways to be part of contributing to our success as a nation, and then going on and building the future success of the nation. Because one of the reasons Australians have become very nervous about migration is they feel that people are coming to our country and getting the benefits without making the contribution. And I want the best, boldest, most confident new Australians we can have.
But do you also think net overseas migration should be tied somehow to housing completion rates, that it should be limited in that way?
Well, that's why I use the word integration. It's not just about economic, social and cultural integration, though it is. It's also about making sure they're able to integrate successfully to get jobs, to get housing, and of course that that doesn't come at the expense of Australians as well. So I absolutely believe we need to tie our migration program to better outcomes for our nation, because that's also the basis that we have social licence from Australians to continue to have new Australians arrive.
Your tone on migration is quite different to some of your colleagues in the Liberal Party. You are one of the few urban Liberals left, and only 6 months ago you fought against the decision to drop the net zero target. You said at the time you didn't want the Liberals to turn into National Party light. Do you ever contemplate whether this is still the right party for you?
No, absolutely not. I spend every day fighting for the future of the country, and because I actually believe in a bold, confident Liberal vision for the country where Australia doesn't just look at itself with a sense of positivity and optimism, but also looking to the world and saying, we can do this. I've said this in a speech recently, that you know, the Labor vision of our country is one currently of managing decline. I want the spirit of the boxing kangaroo to define who we are, and that we look to the rest of the world and say, we can take that on.
When it comes to preferences, you have shifted your position over the years on this. You said in 2019 your long-standing view was that One Nation and their despicable acolytes should be put last. Any association with the party, you said, was toxic. At last year's election, you didn't put them last. What's your view now? Did the Liberal Party make the right call in Farah on preferences?
Well, the challenge these days is that there's so many different people for competing for the last position on the ballot paper in Goldstein, and so it's not just One Nation anymore. I wish it were that simple, but it's not. So, you know, we'll make these decisions based on what obviously puts us in the best position to defeat the government, to be in a position to win seats, because politics is zero sum. Somebody wins, somebody loses, and I want to make sure that Liberal candidates are elected, but we do that by being our best, not by providing pathways to anyone else, including the Teals, including Labor, including the Greens, and of course that includes One Nation too.
But do you think this decision in Farah, which helped One Nation win, adds to their credibility and legitimacy?
Well, there's no point pretending otherwise. When you win seats, it obviously gives them an opportunity, a platform. That comes also with risks. And so they're there now. And, of course, the performance of One Nation will be hinged on David Farley and, of course, the defector Barnaby Joyce. And how they perform now will obviously go on to inform how Australians see
them. Was this Liberal Party decision on preferences the right call or the wrong call?
Well, it was a call that was made, and it's obviously one that you know, has delivered a result.
But what do you think, though? The right call or the wrong call?
I actually think the brutal truth is I think it's the wrong question. I don't think it would have made any difference. I've seen polling data from Albury booths where we preferenced them and people still went off and preferenced Millthorpe. And I think if you go to rural and regional seats, you'll see exactly the same thing in the other direction had we taken our preferences in the other direction. I think the clear message from this is voters wanted to send a really clear message. Our job is to listen to that message, to hear it, and to understand how we have to be better if we want to regain their trust.
And for the record, are you open to forming any sort of minority government with One Nation MPs?
Well, it all comes down to what Australians put up. I want to stop the Albanese government from continuing to wreck Australia, continuing to go to elections saying one thing, then within 12 months, despite 50 times saying taking certain policy positions on things like tax, then overturning them at the first budget that comes along.
So that's interesting. You're open to, even if that involves forming minority government with One Nation, a party you've described as despicable and toxic and so on, you'd be willing to do that?
My objective is to make sure that the Liberal Party is in a position to govern as strongly as possible. Of course, we traditionally form a coalition with the National Party, but it's up to the Australian people to decide who they want to vote for. But I can tell you quite clearly, my objective is to make sure that Liberals beat One Nation candidates.
All right, let's turn to the budget, Tim Wilson. You led the charge back in 2019 against Labor's plans on franking credits in particular. You wanted to protect the status quo. Are you now going to fight to defend existing rules on capital gains tax and negative gearing?
Well, I'll absolutely be looking at what the government announces in the budget. So far, their budget seems to be in complete disarray, where the narrative the Treasurer was putting forward was, we're doing all of this for intergenerational equity. If you believe the leaks that have come out of the budget bunker in the past 12 hours, they're now saying, well, boomers will be protected, but young Australians won't be able to get their first foot on the ladder of opportunity. My position is this is clear, which is we need to be having a tax system that's orientated towards encouraging wealth creation, jobs and growth for the next generation of Australians. Labor's plan is to feed resentment and redistribution. We have wildly different views about how to build the future of the country.
So does that mean you'll vote against any changes to negative gearing and capital gains tax?
Well, I will have to wait and see the details, of course. They haven't been announced. We've had conflicting budget leaks, whether they're malicious because the Prime Minister's trying to humiliate the Treasurer.
Sure, but I mean, right now, you either think the current rules are working or they're not.
Well, again, I'll come and have a look at the what the government's going to put forward before declaring my position.
But right now, do you think the tax breaks are working, are good, are equitable?
Well, I think you're misframing them in saying they're just tax breaks. A lot of them are saying don't. If you lose money, you don't get taxes applied to them. You know, through our website, www.notthetax.com.au, we've already getting stories from young Australians who are saving for a deposit. They're putting their money in the markets, of course, to grow it and to invest so they can get their home ownership brought forward. And they're telling us stories about how they're now going to get double the tax rate applied because of what Labor is seeking to do.
But do you accept
it's actually
there's far
pushing
more...
them further behind rather than further ahead.
There's no doubt some young Australians in that camp, but do you accept there's far 43%
more? 43% of Australians invest in different forms of shares, David, so it's not a
But young
small
Australians
camp.
Who you've identified, do you accept there's far more who aren't holding an investment property, can't get into the market, who do look at some of these rules and think they're just not fair?
Well, the question then is, will these rules and changing these rules lead to more houses being built? People are arguing very clearly no. The Commonwealth Bank chief economist has come out and been scathing, saying it'll raise a whole bunch of revenue but not lead to building new homes. And we've had research this week which has suggested that rents could go up by up to $160 a week in Sydney, about $130 in Melbourne. So the government is just taking from young Australians and from older Australians and not giving them anything in return. It's very hard to see how you could back that.
Nonetheless, you're open to looking at whatever they do here.
Well, I'm an open-minded person, okay. David, but I would just stress this, is on the principle of what we're seeing so far, it would be very hard to support.
On trusts, look, they are legitimately used, of course, by farmers, small business and so on, but as the economist Chris Richardson points out, they also create options to lower taxes in ways that are simply not open to the vast bulk of Australians. He describes the way trusts are used by high-wealth individuals as long-standing unfairness in the system. Are you saying there should be no change on trusts?
Well, again, I'll come down to the detail of what the government's putting forward. They seem to have a blanket ban approach rather than looking at targeted measures. And so on this basis, small businesses are going to get smashed in particular. And for so many small businesses, their small business isn't just, you know, how they manage their day-to-day finances. And it's the base in which the first kid gets a job employed in a community, and it's also the basis of their retirement savings, so they're coming after that as well.
Look, I want to talk about spending here as well, the other side of the budget. Would you oppose any more cost of living handouts in this budget?
Well, again, we've said previously with the cut on the fuel excise, it should be accompanied with inflationary offsets, because when you don't have inflationary offsets, you're giving with one hand, you're taking with the other, and you're actually increasing the pressure on Australian households. We don't have the detail on what the government is putting forward, but if they don't provide inflationary offsets, they're going to perpetuate the cycle, because at the end of the day, Labor's economic model is what it is. Stoke the inflation, tax the inflation, then spend the inflation and repeat the cycle. And that's why Australians are doing it so tough right now.
If there are net savings, as the Treasurer says there will be, and that includes cost of living support, some additional cost of living relief, would you support that?
Well, I'll have a look at it when he provides that, because previously the Treasurer has said that he saved $114 billion and then in the next breath he's gone on and spent an additional $223 billion and stoked the inflation cycle again. So the difference between what he says and what he does can be radically different.
If there are net savings, and again that's what he's saying there will be, we'll find out the quantum on Tuesday night, Can you give us a sense of whether you think we need drastic savings, drastic spending cuts, or just tweaking here at the moment?
Well, my view has always been that we need to reduce spending quite considerably to, and the first place to target is the fraud and corruption that exists within the system, whether it's the $15 billion that's been provided to organised crime through the CFMEU Labor cartel, the somewhere between 10 and 20% of the NDIS budget that continues to explode out, that's finding its way to fraud and corruption. We have nearly $500 million of measures where phantom children are being enrolled in childcare services. I think all of that fraud and corruption absolutely needs to be cut out.
What about your own spending plans? Matt Canavan, the Nationals leader, is talking about resurrecting the Inland Rail project all the way through to Queensland. Is that the Coalition's policy or just the Nats?
Well, we will ultimately make a decision collectively as a party, but our focus is on how we make sure there's investment to build out the future economic growth of the country. The problem is Labor seems to be saying no to Inland Rail, which is no to farmers and no to jobs in the regions, but we're going to hand it to the Suburban Rail Loop, a program which is known for its connection to corruption and organised crime, and to prop up the failing Allan Labor government in Victoria.
But on Inland Rail, you're still to be convinced by Matt Canavan on that?
Well, no decision's been made, David, but I can tell you the one thing. No one I've spoken to in the Coalition, Liberal or National, has thought taking money out of projects designed to grow the future of the Australian economy and give it to organised crime through Victorian Labor government projects is a way forward.
Shadow Treasurer Tim Wilson, thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Well, coming up, charges laid and the challenge of reintegration. We'll look at the return of ISIS-linked families. First, let's get back to our panel. Nikki Saver from the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, Greg Brown from The Australian and Melissa Clark from the ABC. Nikki, just want to come back to Farah and what we heard there from Tim Wilson. It is a different tone on issues like migration, the preference decision as well. But he is very much defending Angus Taylor and flagging that they will be bold and brave on policy. What did you make of that?
Well, and also flagging that they would be willing to join with One Nation in whatever kind of coalition.
And for someone like Tim Wilson to say that's interesting.
Exactly. So the Liberal Party would be aligning itself with a party which at its core is racist and bigoted. So that would be a very different Liberal Party from the one which was formed and which existed for a few decades, but has obviously now decided that the way forward for them is not to head back to the sensible centre, but to veer even further right. So I found it quite interesting that he was open to that proposition.
That's why, well, partly why this is such a seismic moment at Fields, this by-election, right? Because, yes, to hear people who aren't, you know, hard right conservatives in the Liberal Party now accepting that they may need to sit with One Nation in any future government.
Yeah, well, I think the issue is that you've had the polling has increased so dramatically for One Nation and is stuck. Pretty much has come down a bit, but it's pretty much stuck. Then they've done well in South Australia. They've done well in this by-election. They've won the by-election. So it does. The more wins One Nation gets, the more it empowers, I think, people in the community to look at One Nation. Mm. And that's a real worry for the Liberal Party. But I think ultimately, while this is certainly a bad result, I don't think it necessarily changes where the Liberal MPs felt they were at. They knew when they made the change to Angus Taylor, they were in big trouble. That their first thing they needed to do, a process that could take years, was win back their conservative flank before then they're able to pull themselves together to target Labor.
But just on this, sorry Mel, just on this point about whether, you know, they can only get back to government by being in a minority with One Nation, Labor are going to be all over this. In fact, they already are. Treasurer Jim Chalmers has been out this morning. He spoke to our ABC colleague Jane Norman, and yeah, have a look at his reaction to the to this by-election result.
This wasn't a by-election, it was a bloodbath for the Coalition. And what it shows is that the Coalition can't beat One Nation. They'll have to join them. There's no future Coalition government, I think, without One Nation in it. On the broader atmospherics, the broader politics of the Farah by-election, This government doesn't lightly dismiss or deny the very real concerns that people have, which are encouraging them to consider political alternatives.
And you can watch that full interview with the Treasurer on the ABC News channel and the ABC News website. But Mel, yes, a reflection there that Labor's got to have a look at what the implications are for them. But this whole line, they are going to run hard on that, that a vote for Liberal means a one nation government.
Yeah, Labor has gone straight in here for the political positioning question, and of course they've gone there and they'll make merry with that. But I think this is also what the Liberal Party needs to address, is at the moment they are very focused on where they position themselves politically. But what that does means is they're just contesting with One Nation for who can be the strongest or the clearest on their focus on topic X or topic Y. Immigration, clearly the key one, and Angus Taylor is continuing to do that straight in the aftermath of this result. But if they are to differentiate themselves from One Nation, they need to show that they can be a party of government in the way that One Nation can't. And to do that, they actually need realistic policies that can address the issues that One Nation is very good at identifying and other parties are good at identifying. They need to differentiate with policy development. And so far, we haven't seen them come forward with any kind of policies that suggests they can.
The exact opposite. The policies that they are now heading towards are immigration still. I mean, that was the one policy that Taylor released in the lead up to the Farah by-election, which was basically plagiarising One Nation and Donald Trump.
That wasn't a clear, comprehensive policy to address an issue, though. That was identifying that immigration is an issue and we'll do something about it. But I don't think we've got from...
In competition with One Nation, but not... They have not produced a single policy that shows that they have actually understood the threats that they've faced, not just from the right, but from the progressive side. They've lost both. So you would think they would now head towards the sensible centre, as Susan Lee said, but never did. And unless they do that, they just become, you know, a sub-branch of One Nation.
I think what the aim is, as far as I can ascertain, is they want to talk about these cultural issues initially to try and stem the bleed, and then ultimately they feel One Nation will be vulnerable on the economy. I mean, their big economic policy income splitting, they just never bothered costing it.
They can beat them on the economy.
Yeah, and they feel, to answer Mel's conundrum, that's the way that they can sort of piece it all together. Easier said than done. I think a real worry for the establishment, both the Coalition and the Labor Party, to be frank, is that it seems at the moment, no matter what Pauline Hanson says or does, her supporters forgive her.
Well, the problems with the candidate, or, you know, none of that seems to matter much.
You know, the no good Muslims, doubting whether there were good Muslims in Australia comment, that hasn't hurt her. Having a convicted rapist on her staff, that hasn't hurt her. All the issues with Farley and his flirtation with Labor and the fact he was hidden during the campaign.
This is a vote driven by frustration at the current system.
A Coalition member said to me last night that there is no brand loyalty out there except to Pauline.
There you go. Yeah. All right, well, let's turn to the government, because it is budget week. We've got just 2 days to go, and as we heard, the opposition is gearing up for a fight over changes to negative gearing and capital gains tax and trusts. The government is set to break a promise on the investment tax breaks, arguing it's now the right thing to do.
The federal budget next week will feature changes to the capital gains tax, negative gearing.
Can you rule out any changes to negative gearing and capital gains tax settings?
Yes. How hard is it for the 50th time?
And whatever happened to my word is my bond?
This government and this Prime Minister is incompetent, is fraudulent, and is a liar.
So if we come to a different view in the budget on Tuesday night,
you'll be upfront.
Then
about
we
it.
Will explain that. We'll be upfront about that. What matters most is that governments take the right decisions for the right reasons.
So as we saw there, only 12 months ago at the election campaign, the Prime Minister ruling out changes on negative gearing and capital gains tax. They're coming though on the Tuesday night. Has a whole lot changed in the space of 12 months to justify this?
Well, speaking to people within Labor, it's sort of what changed between now and the election, they're not really giving particularly compelling reasons when it comes to, obviously, we're in the middle of the Strait of Hormuz being closed and whatever, but this is kind of a separate issue.
Hmm.
I think the challenge for them is that if they had have gone about it in a way that appeared to be holistic, so, you know, when they first started talking before the economic reform roundtable, if they had have looked more at different kind of taxation that they hadn't looked at before, maybe the GST, if they had have used some of this revenue that's coming to promise tax cuts in the future for younger people, I think that would have been a more compelling way to sell tackling intergenerational inequity. Because a young person, I don't think, is necessarily looking at someone who's got an investment property.
Well, we'll see where they land in terms of the holistic nature of it, but you're right, it might just be limited to changing those rules. Bottom line, Nikki, should Anthony Albanese and Jim Chalmers have been clear at the election 12 months ago that this was going to happen?
Well, obviously that would have been preferable. I mean, there are always a lot of risks with breaking promises, but if last night showed anything to the political classes is that people are sick of the status quo. They want governments to do something, something big, something bold, something that will potentially change and improve their lives, right? So if Chalmers and Albanese can sell this after we know the full details, that, you know, this is what it will do for you, and then they will combine that with their decisions on funding housing, infrastructure and so on, then they might just cut through. But I think people are looking for governments to do something big and bold.
I think that's the fundamental point. This is tied to what we saw last night, you're right, because the view is if they're just sitting there doing little
status
with a big
quo,
94-seat majority, they're going to be punished for that. They've obviously come to the conclusion that the risk of breaking the promise outweighs the risk of being seen to do nothing in this climate where people do want that sort of bold action. But Mel, the danger too is trust in government is weakened by this.
And part of the difficulty is that Anthony Albanese himself has been the key person talking about the decline in trust in public figures and public institutions and has tried to make a virtue of delivery. How many times have we heard Anthony Albanese talk about, my government delivers, this is what we said we do and now we're going about delivering it. He's made a virtue of delivering on what has been promised. So it makes it additionally difficult for them to make the case for breaking a promise. But I completely agree that there is an appetite for governments to be more active. We don't have the kind of political system you might have in the UK where your election manifesto can't really be strayed from without a new mandate. There is a desire for governments to be responsive. They've just made the task harder for themselves, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, just going back onto that, the trust element, I mean, that was a reason Jim Chalmers did leave open a conversation about the GST when he first announced the Economic Reform Roundtable. The Prime Minister shut it down. When he was asked later, why did you shut it down, he said it would have been a breach of faith just after an election, given there's a lot of anxiety in the community. And now they're just sort of, yes, they're being active, but they are just dusting off old policies that they took to the 2019 election. I just think, as we'll see how it all lands in the end, we're not expecting too many surprises. I think my colleague Matthew Cranston has broken most of the budget. So I'm not expecting an income tax cut in this or any other sort of...
No, but I think his report on some sort of offset for wage earners coming in about a year's time.
Yes, well, there's a one-off rebate, yeah. But as far as, you know, being able to sell it as a package that they can say, well, we're not just... This isn't a tax grab. We're actually trying to improve the system.
But the question is whether voters want it or not. And if voters want it, they will forgive a government for supporting it, not supporting it, actually going ahead with it. So the question is, have they read the temperature of voters well enough? That will be whether or not the broken promise is
a problem
or not.
The government will be breathing a lot easier if it turns out the coalition don't block what they do. And it's fascinating that, you know, you hear from Tim Wilson there, let's just wait and see. They're not saying we'll vote to keep
the current system. Well, trust is a two-way thing, though. Trust me to do what I say I'm going to do, but also trust me to change when I think there needs to be change, right? And the job then is to convince people of the need for that.
But that comes back to, has the world changed that much in 12 months on negative gearing and capital gains
tax? Well, not on negative gearing and capital gains tax, but the world has changed enormously, even in only the past few months. There are so many things that have been happening outside of our control. Thank you, Donald Trump, for creating so much chaos and misery. So it would be, I think, irresponsible for the government to sit there now with such a stonking majority and say there's nothing we can do about
because
anything.
We're handcuffed.
We'll just stick to what we were doing.
A couple of other budget things. Well, today the Treasury is announcing $2 billion in housing support to get more housing projects going with that sort of last mile infrastructure, water, sewerage, power, roads and so on. It sounds very similar to what Peter Dutton took to the election 12 months ago.
It certainly is, and also the then Dutton opposition had taken things like freezing the construction code to the election, which Labor did very quickly after winning the election. So it's not the first time that we've seen Labor go to places where the coalition has been before. But I think what we take from this is a signal that Labor recognises how acute this issue is and that it needs to do everything, like every little policy tweak that it can, because no one thing, you know, negative gearing alone isn't going to change it. Throwing more money at social and affordable housing alone isn't going to change the scenario. I think this is a sign that the government is trying to act on as many fronts as possible on the housing question, knowing that there is no quick silver bullet.
Yeah. And that is what they will be judged on at the next election, not whether they tweaked negative gearing or CGT, but whether they've actually provided more housing.
So there has to be a supply element to whatever they announce. Yeah.
But this is the thing, like my understanding is this is the main supply element in the budget. So you've got, they're talking about supply being the main issue. Negative gearing and capital gains tax won't raise, will raise less than $5 billion over the forwards, but over the 10 years, I think Shorten's policy was projected to raise more than $30 billion. And then they're raising, possibly $2 billion a year through trusts. So you do wonder if there's no income tax cut, it's just an extra $2 billion for housing, the money is going into the budget to fund their broader programs and also to reduce debt, which is important, but I think the tax is also called for. Yeah.
Now, just one other thing in the pre-budget, list of pre-budget announcements. Boy, it feels like now budget season's 3 weeks of announcements, not just one night of announcements. The gas, East Coast domestic gas reservation. A lot of details, TBC, I think, Mel, but how will this work from what they've announced?
Yeah, I think there has been a lot of confusion because the government has been very keen to emphasise that this won't impact existing contracts. They want to say that first, and then we're going to develop this 20% reservation of gas production. But actually, it's the other way around. What they're doing is they're putting a 20% reservation of production for export, and they're going to accommodate effectively the existing contracts to try to ensure that it does not have a deleterious effect on them. So this is quite significant because
what if a company is already contracted more than 80% of the gas and they can't find 20% that's uncontracted?
Well, this is what hasn't been developed in the detail, but the idea is they will try to find mechanisms for them to do that. So does that mean they need to have a market solution where they pay another gas producer to provide more? Someone else provides 22%, but they only provide 18%, and maybe there's a way that they can accommodate that. Likewise, there's also questions about, well, WA's got a 15% reservation. How are they going to get to 20%? What do you do about the Northern Territory when it's not connected to broader domestic infrastructure? None of these details are clear yet and haven't been settled, but the whole point is they are trying to make everyone do it, and it will affect existing contracts in that they will have to make accommodations.
And bottom line, more gas available domestically to drive the price down, and manufacturers saying hallelujah because they've long complained that the gas price has just gone too high since we started exporting.
Yep, and the producers are obviously unhappy about it because the government is saying it's not retrospective, but if you've got an existing contract, quite frankly, it's gone further than I expected. If you've got an existing contract and you've got to find 20% extra gas, like while the contract is not impacted, your overall operations obviously are. So I think there could be people making the case that it's retrospective.
Now, just quickly, the ISIS-linked families that arrived home during the week, 4 women, 9 kids. 3 of the women quickly charged with various terrorism and crimes against humanity offences, including enslavement. A lot of the political debate, Nikki, has been about whether more could have been done to stop them actually getting here at all. Is it clear the government could have done anything more to stop them?
I think once the women were reissued with passports, then there was no way they could be stopped.
But Angus Taylor says shouldn't have given them passports.
Yeah, well, perhaps, maybe he's right there, but that is an incredibly difficult thing to do, to deny an Australian citizen a passport. That leads to all sorts of other legal questions and requirements. So whether that was a mistake or whether they thought it just wasn't worth the fight, who knows? But once that happened, it was impossible to stop them. So now it becomes making sure that they pose no threat, and that means maybe the women will eventually go to prison. But it's also a question about the children and how they're going to be looked after, because de-radicalisation programs are not compulsory.
No, they're not. So what do we know about what's happening there with those kids, Mel?
Yeah, look, we know that the various state government and state policing authorities say that they, one, have dealt with previous cohorts that have returned several years ago, and that they have significant plans in place to try to make sure that the children are in a position to be able to gently reintegrate into mainstream society. I think when it comes to the question of the government's role in this, it's clear the threshold for denying someone a passport is very high and on security grounds, and short of us seeing classified security information, we kind of have to take it that what we have been told is that it didn't meet that threshold. But for some of them, clearly, there has been enough information to prosecute them. And if we have Australian citizens who have committed crimes to the point we feel that there is a case to be made against them and we can prosecute them and take them to court, I think it's very hard for the Coalition to argue that that shouldn't happen. What, we should have Australian citizens who may have committed crimes and we have evidence to prosecute them, but no, we don't want to do that?
Yeah,
we want to let them escape the justice system? I think that's a very hard position for the Coalition to continue to maintain. Now they're here and have been charged.
And just briefly on this, Greg, once you take the politics out of it, it was interesting Mike Burgess, the ASIO boss, this week when he was talking about it, did seem comfortable that the arrangements were in place to manage this cohort.
Yeah, and I think this was important for the overall sort of politics of it, I guess, that the government, you know, with its words, has taken a pretty hard line on it. And I think they're very cognizant about the community concerns about migration. I think that's real. And the fact that they were arrested right away, I think does ease community concerns that, while the government says they're facing the full force of the law, well, there it is. They've already been arrested and charged. So, let's see how it plays out. But even Mike Pezzullo himself has said that he thinks it was inevitable that they were going to have to come back home.
Yeah, and don't forget there's more Australians still in that camp in particular. Let's get some final observations. Mel?
Just for something a bit different, during the week there was a report released into the Woomera Protected Area and the what's called the Coexistence Framework, but it's basically how Defence continue to do testing outs on the sites, but the land is also used by agriculture, mining, cultural purposes, and this was reassessing how that sharing's going on. It's come to the conclusion that there is so much uncertainty and concern about the global strategic environment that they think defence needs to have much more control over that land in how much they use it, how little notice they need to give other users when they want to do things like testing new missiles, because there needs to be a primacy on defence activities to ensure that they can uphold our national security. I thought it was a really interesting insight into how concerned defence is and how they're approaching what they see as a very, very uncertain global security future.
Yeah, good example of how those heightened concerns are having implications elsewhere. Greg?
Well, as the government prepares to explain why it's broken election promises, I think it's worth looking back on the evolution of the Albanese government's fidelity to election promises. And I remember after the voice referendum failed, the very next day, senior ministers came out and said it was always going to be hard to win once Peter Dutton opposed it, but but we pushed ahead anyway because the Prime Minister is the kind of guy that wants to honour election commitments. 6 months after that stage three, they broke a promise on stage three. We're about to see more broken promises now. So they have been selective on trust and keeping promises. And I think the real question is whether voters will see through it.
We will see. Nikki.
Well, yesterday marked the 125th anniversary of the founding of the Federal Parliamentary Press Gallery and also the 99th birthday of Old Parliament House. And if you want to see how reporting and reporters have changed over the decades and how they have had to adapt to help democracy prosper and survive, how an institution as important as the press gallery changes rather than dying off, then I thoroughly recommend that exhibition to everyone, especially in the current circumstance.
Oh, good shout, and happy birthday to the press gallery at large and the original parliament in Australia. Thank you all very much for joining us. Big morning, big week, big budget week ahead. Thank you. Well, finally, he's called the US Secretary for everything. Marco Rubio is officially the Secretary of State and the National Security Advisor. But when he filled in for the White House Press Secretary, it became clear Marco Rubio may be taking on too much. We'll leave you with that. Thanks for watching.
I don't know who you all are, but I mean, I know who some of you are, but I don't know all of you are.
There's no way I can figure out who to call on. I'm just going to like press right in the middle, right there. Can you put name tags on? I'm winging it, guys, okay? Right there. Yes. They gave me a little map. I don't know where I put it of the people here. Some of you had like red X's. I'm kidding. No, it's not true. Right there in the black. This is chaos, guys. No. Did I call on you already? I need to get a laser pointer and just go back row, yellow tie.
You're making us all feel very excited about being here.